When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome, everybody, to Finding Hermes. This is episode 4. I hope, like me, you're ready to put all your cards on the table and ready to walk through some doors. With us, I have the pleasure of having my friend and colleague, Brian Stanford. Brian, thanks for coming on Finding Hermes.
Thanks for having me, Miguel. I'm honored to be here.
Pleasure is all mine. Well, let's go on a journey, your journey of finding Hermes, if you would. And I know it's always a loaded question. I think in AA, they talk about where I've been, how did I get out, why am I here? But it's always important. But could you tell us maybe what were the atmosphere or the context in which Brian Stanford grew up and then had his fall, and then we can talk about your fall and redemption, your hero's journey, and out of Plato's cave, use your esoteric metaphor as you would.
Sure. So I grew up, I'm 47 years old. I grew up in a suburb of Houston in Spring, Texas, middle class, white family. Both my parents were public school teachers. Had one younger sister, and grew up as a punk rock kid, discovered skateboarding and the Sex Pistols pretty early on, which I like to joke both saved and destroyed my life at the same time. And grew up in a very liberally minded household. My mother was fairly religious, and my father was pretty militantly atheist and a socialist and kind of angry Vietnam vet, a free thinker, someone who always challenged me to have my own opinions and look at, you know, the myriad sides of various issues. So I feel like I got some healthy spirituality from my mom and some healthy skepticism and critical mind from my dad. And I guess when I was around 14 years old at a Barnes & Noble bookstore, just browsing through the occult section because it seemed kind of spooky or edgy, and I was a kind of an edgy kid, and I found, is it Donald Michael Craig? I can never remember the combination of his name, but the famous American occultist died a few years back, but wrote Modern Magic. It was like 12 lessons in high magic. And I saved up some of my money and bought it. And that was, I guess, kind of my launch into the spiritual world. I would practice the LBRP in my bathrobe with a pilfered kitchen knife and candle in the middle of the night, and got quickly interested in philosophy, kind of grew up on kung fu movies, was always into martial arts, thought I'd like to be a Shaolin monk because that seemed pretty cool. That made me want to start investigating Buddhism. And then one auspicious day when I was about 16 years old, I guess, I ran across the Hare Krishnas at a street festival in downtown Houston, and they had a book that had the Buddha on it, and I thought, ah, these guys must be Buddhists. There's an image of the Buddha. Let me go ask them about Buddhism. And they gave me a free plate of food and told me to come by the temple if I wanted to talk about Buddhism. And I don't know how much people here know about the Hare Krishnas, but in their scheme of the world, Krishna, all the other gods are a manifestation of Krishna. So when I got to the temple, they were like, yeah, Buddha's really cool. Let us tell you about Krishna. And from 16 to my early 20s, I was deeply involved in the Hare Krishna movement, lived in and out of the temple. At that time, late 80s, early 90s, the Hare Krishnas had a real big push into punk rock music and were kind of evangelizing to a lot of straight edge, hardcore kids, which I definitely was. And so was involved in the Hare Krishna temple, was constantly flirting with becoming a brahmachari or a monk, but could never quite give up my attachment to women. And then one day in my early 20s, I was hanging out at the temple and the main guru called me in and was like, okay, Bhakta Brian, you know, you're obviously not cut out to be a monk. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to marry so-and-so. And he pointed to a woman and another young devotee in the room. He's like, you're going to marry her. We're going to set you up at the house three doors away from the temple. You're going to sell books. She's going to work in the kitchen. You'll have kids. It'll be great. And he basically just laid out to me what my life was about to be as a devotee of this guru. And I left the temple and didn't come back for many, many years. It just completely freaked me out. It scared me to death. Caused me to kind of question everything that was being taught there. And then from there, I bounced around. I still kind of wanted to be a monk and lived in a Zen monastery for a while, lived in some different urban meditation centers. And along the way, got addicted to heroin. I was also reading a lot of Burroughs and the Beats and all of that kind of stuff and smoking weed and taking psychedelics. But I've always been someone who pushes towards the edge. And heroin definitely seemed like the edge. And at that time, you're old enough to remember, that was like when all the grunge stuff was happening. And, you know, perversely, heroin was making this comeback into the culture. Right. And I got very deeply addicted and involved in heroin dealing and heroin selling and drug dealing and selling guns, and just kind of went down this whole rabbit hole of pretty hardcore outlaw life. And it is really something I wanted. I mean, I think of it now as the Gnostic urge is what I kind of call it. Like I definitely recognize that the setup or the way that the setup of the culture was being presented to me was hollow and that there was really no meaning in it. And the meaning had to be found outside of the boundaries. And so that's what I was trying to do. And oddly, out of all the heroin addicted friends that I knew, I was also the only one that was meditating and reading sutras and chanting mantras and living in temple. Yeah, it was a really strange, it was a very, very strange life. And I lived that way as an addict for about 10 years, still deeply pursuing the spiritual path. And kind of after 10 years of that and just being in various desperate situations, I had gotten in some trouble with the law. I was on the run. The police were looking for me. I was kind of moving amongst cities in Texas, trying to stay one step ahead of things. And got the idea that I needed to try to get out of the country and that I needed to generate some money. By this point, I had stopped using street drugs. I was on methadone. I was definitely trying to get away from the drugs, but I was addicted. I'd kind of ruined myself for any kind of normal job. I was facing some pretty petty charges in hindsight, but I was just too scared to turn myself in. I had some active warrants for my arrest. My family was really trying to convince me to just surrender to the police, but I couldn't do it. I was too scared of going to jail. And I really felt trapped I felt trapped in this life that no longer suited me anymore. I felt trapped in this outlaw existence, and I really wanted to kind of leave that behind and be and find a way to work in the world. But you know, I had an expired driver's license. I couldn't get a new one. I couldn't rent an apartment. I couldn't drive a car. I couldn't get a job. So I came up with the idea to rob some banks. And
very logical, yeah. The mind of an addict.
Yeah, exactly.
What could possibly go wrong?
Right. And so I did, and I did a series of bank robberies in Austin, Texas. The first two were incredibly easy. I walked in with a note. They handed me the money. I walked out and got on my mountain bike and skated away. And on the third one, I walked in, gave him my note, got the money, walked out, got on my mountain bike, skated away to my hideout, and got there and realized there was a tracker taped between two $20 bills. And I was at a hotel, and I immediately tried to I went outside to throw the tracker in a drain. And there were just police circling the building, and there was a helicopter in the air. And funnily, I left my hotel room to go do this in such a panic that I locked the key in the hotel room. So I had to go back in the front lobby, ask for the extra key while everybody's like looking out the window going, what the hell? Why are all the cops out there? Got my key, went upstairs, tried to flush the tracker. It got stuck in the bend in the toilet. And at that point I was like, shit, I got to get out of here. And I called a cab. The cab came and picked me up. Somehow the cops let the cab leave the hotel parking lot. It was really weird. I don't think they had an exact location. This was maybe pretty early in the days of GPS. I think they knew there was something in that area, but not a pinpoint. But anyway, I left in a cab, and about a day later they tracked me down and arrested me. And that put an end to my, to that, really that put an end to that part of my life.
How did they track you, or since without a tracker?
I still don't really know. I had gone back to a girlfriend's house, and they showed up at her house. I had talked to her a couple of times on the hotel phone, and it could have just been that simple. When they arrested me, one of the cops, you know, like shoved a piece of paper in my face that had my name on it. And he was like, do you know who I am? I've had your face on TV and in the newspapers. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, you know? So they had been looking for me. So I don't know. I really don't, you know, they don't
a matter of time
how they do all that. Yeah. And so they arrested me, and I pled guilty and was sentenced to 10 years, in the Texas prison system. And, I ended up serving 6 years in prison, 4 years on parole, and got out in 2009 and have been out since. And I'm sure
before we continue, something's coming about our discussion we had in our Finding Hermes group, our private group, or the Citizens of the Virtual Alexandria. You give a great talk on the Gnostic Eucharist and eating a god and all that, but first, I like to say it's interesting about your life because, yeah, it's almost like there are those who are born like we are seekers. We live between chaos and order. We want some religion that'll just say do A, B, C, and this chaos inside your head and heart will be fine. But at the same time, we reject it and we just continue.
Yeah.
We're addicted to that chaos. And in a way, like with you, Gnosticism sort of gave both. In my life, it's like you can embrace Dionysus, but you can also, and Sophia, the wild Sophia, but the order of the Aeons. But we continue with that. And like you, I remember as a kid, even, well, these days I always say, yeah, when I was raised Catholic, I had my savior was Jesus, but my secret savior was Bruce Lee. I mean, that was sort of something about Bruce or Billy Jack, or later on it'd be like a Jackie, something about those kung fu. Again, it brought that chaos and order that we wanted from these very mercurial martial arts people. They were both order, and they were ice and fire. But in prison, did you say that's really when you saw or experienced true evil, or was it later on? Or tell us about your experience there and the spirituality there.
Yeah. Well, so when I got arrested, obviously, you know, when you get arrested for bank robbery, it's considered a very serious charge, even though there was no violence in my crime or weapon. I was using a note, but understandably, the state treats it as a violent crime, a robbery. And so when I started out in prisons, I started out in maximum security prison units in Texas. And then over the years that came after that, I worked my way from maximum security to minimum security. And so went from, you know, the kind of cell that you could literally stand in the middle and do this and touch each wall, and you're just locked in there 23 and a half hours with another person all the time. I went from that to, by the time I got out of prison, I was at a trustee camp where there's like nobody with guns. You can just walk out the door and walk. The only thing that's keeping you there is they know you don't want to ruin the fact that you're probably going home soon. So my prison experience really ran the gambit of all of that. But I do feel like, it was in prison that I experienced both some of the most selfless, pure good that I've ever experienced in my life, and also some of the darkest evils that I've seen in my life. And interestingly, while I definitely met some prisoners who would fall under the heading of evil people, or at least people who had done some evil things. And I definitely encountered some men who relished in their evilness. But when I think of the evil in prison, I think mainly of a lot of the guards that I encountered just did things, you know, from what you could call like the banality of evil. And you know, we kind of talked about it in the Finding Hermes private group, this idea of the archons, of like bureaucrats that are just there to kind of try to keep you as a slave. One of the things I can remember is by the time I got to the trustee camp, I started taking some college courses because I wasn't seeking a degree, but I really just wanted to take some interesting courses. They had an anthropology class I wanted to take, and a history class that I wanted to take, and a philosophy class that I wanted to take. And so I signed up for these college courses, and when I would leave the trustee camp to go to the prison, the absolute hatred that some of the guards showed towards the men who were going to college, and the humiliating strip searches that they would put you through, or the destruction of your work that they would do, the petty harassments of making you stand naked in the rain in the wintertime for extended periods of time just to try to harass you so much that you wouldn't go to college, which it really blew my mind, because every statistic I could find showed that, you know, the number one thing that you can do for a man in prison is give him an education in regards to keeping him from coming back. I think the recidivism rates in Texas are something like 75% to 80% of the average prisoner goes back to prison. If you get them a high school diploma, that drops down to 50%. If they go to one semester of college, it drops down to 15%. And so I was like, why are these guys trying to make it so hard for me to go to college? And I think there was just such a darkness that they were consumed by, almost like an evil spirit. And I know you've dealt with addiction. And one of the things I think about with heroin addiction is that it is quite literally selling your soul to the devil. Like, I think that's what that stuff means. And you really have to fight to get your soul back. But there are certain things that seem to be possessed by a spirit or an energy, and prison has a very dark, heavy, oppressive spirit around it. And I the evil that I really felt was that I thought that the guards and the administration were very determined to attempt to break the men that were there. to just make them into broken creatures that just could not function anymore. And it was very dark. It was very dark. And at the same time, it was juxtaposed with some of the deepest friendship bonds I'd ever experienced. I had friends in prison that, you know, if they had a dollar and I had nothing, well, I had 50 cents, you know, no question about it. People who would put their life on the line for you, literally. It reminds me of things I hear my father talk about with friends in combat. I think there's something about people in these very rough situations that creates a kind of bonding and a compassion and a love and a fraternity that I have never experienced since. And it's a weird thing to miss prison in some way, but I think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn talking about, you know, giving thanks to God for the experience of prison. And I saw so many things there that that I don't think I know I wouldn't have learned or experienced had I not gone.
Yeah, it's like prison was a microcosm of the macrocosm that is planet Earth, except a little bit more intense. So you definitely experience it. And it was it in prison that you cultivate a more esoteric spirituality? It was after you left.
Well, it's interesting. When I like to joke that I had like a white Morgan Freeman character when I was in there. Right. I met an older white guy who was he was a Freemason, and he was really into the Transcendentalists and Thoreau and Emerson and a lot of that. Early American, that pragmatic spirituality that Mitch kind of also seems to have a rooting in. And this guy introduced me to that stuff. He was there for multiple DWIs. He was a lawyer in Texas who just couldn't stop drinking and was just in and out of prison for having so many DWIs. But, you know, he shared Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma with me and would talk about Kabbalah and, would talk a lot about, you know, got me reading Emerson and got me reading Viktor Frankl and definitely planted these seeds with me. Now, when I got out of prison, I was still of a mind of Buddhism. I was practicing Buddhism when I was in prison. And it's kind of curious the route that my path has taken, because this man, his name was Krim, when I was there, he was like gently trying to dissuade me from Buddhism. And he would kind of say, you know, like, you need to, you know, you have a spiritual tradition, like you have a culture and a spiritual tradition, and you should, that's your home. You know, that's where you need to be. And he would tell me these things that I now tell people, you know, that we talked about, like Carl Jung saying, you need to make a reconciliation with the religion of your fathers, or you're never going to individuate, you know. But I wasn't ready to hear it at the time, but I definitely got exposed to that there. And I had a big awakening moment that I prayed for the first time in a long time when I got to the back of the prison gates in the bus. And the first time I got there, and I prayed, I didn't have a concept of God at that time, but I just prayed that I would carry myself in a way that would not bring dishonor to my ancestors. Like, no matter what happens, let me act in a way that my father wouldn't be ashamed of, that my grandfather wouldn't be ashamed of, you know, kind of all the way back through time. And I definitely realized that if I survived my time in prison, I was going to be a changed person, that I had taken for granted. I think of it like this, like my dad came from very poor Tennessee backgrounds and only got to go to college because of the Vietnam War. And then, you know, struggled so hard to pull himself up into the middle class. And then, you know, I'm his firstborn son, and he tries to hand the keys of the kingdom to me. And I just spit in his face and become a heroin addict. You know, I all of his hard work, I did everything I could to just tear it all down. And I realized in prison, I was just taking my life and my patrimony for granted. You know, I vowed if I got out of there alive that I would not, you know, ever take it for granted again. And that was a big part of the spiritual awakening for me in there, is realizing that, you know, my life had a purpose. And I mentioned I took an anthropology class, and the professor who taught it was very instrumental in my redemption. And she would talk to us about the fact that, you know, we were experiencing probably the last place in the Western culture where you could really have the shamanic journey. You know, she was like, you guys fell sick with the illnesses of your culture, with violence, addiction, greed, crime. You fell ill with that and you died. And now you've been buried in the you're in the underworld, and you might not survive this. You know, you might, most people don't. Most people come back, they just fall into this cycle of returning to prison. But she said, if you can redeem yourself, then the next step in that journey is you have to bring something back to the tribe. You know, if you survive the shamanic sickness, it's your goal to then try to bring the lessons of that death and rebirth, back to the community or to the culture. And so I definitely came out of prison with that mission, but was still very much involved in Buddhism and kind of an Eastern flavor of my search.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I was also going to mention too, Brian, talking about the grunge, I think, being a Gen X probably really accentuated this Gnostic worldview, because I think we were really a generation that suddenly looked back and saw how the game was rigged, what a sham society we lived. I mean, yeah, we like 60s music and 80s fun,
yeah,
mix like Top Gun, but we realized that the yuppie generation, the 70s, the 60s, we saw what it was, and it made us extremely cynical, extremely detached, extremely awake, but also extremely destructive, because there was a lot of nihilism and existentialism in the whole with the Gen X and the grunge movement. So like everything, it works for you and against you. Just, you know, our insanity can work for and against us. Our drive to get drugs, if we put it somewhere else, will work for or against us. So I think we were the first really Gnostic generation. I hope these other younger generations will be that, except with the existential angst and despair we had, and not being so detached, we won't participate in any of the systems, except, But, and after, after you got out of prison, let's talk about, when did you get acquainted with those ancient heretics, the Gnostics?
Well, I had gotten out and was living in Austin, Texas, and was practicing some occult stuff and involved in Buddhist studies. And the author and occultist, Craig Williams, I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
Okay, yeah. He was in Austin, and he had a small study group for the Gospel of Thomas. And I started going to his study group there, and he would do a very stripped down in regards to bells and smells of the ritual, but a very potent form of the Eucharist for people who were interested in it at the end of the study. And so I was participating in that and hanging out with Craig some and kind of learning from him. And around that time, David Beth came through town and gave a lecture and made me a deacon in his church. So I had my first like Gnostic initiation there, experience of the holy orders, although I could not make heads or tails of what the hell David and Craig were talking about and what the hell Michael Bertio was talking about. Like I could get no purchase in the sense of like trying to climb a rock or something on what they were saying. It just was going so far over my head, although the experiences were very powerful. So that was my first experience with it, but I just couldn't find my way in. So I just continued on with my Buddhist studies. But I recognized many years later, I think particularly the Eucharists that I was able to partake in with Craig and definitely the initiation that I received at the hands of David, really put some seeds inside of me that weren't quite ready to bloom. They needed some more watering and some more time, or maybe even when you talk about those guys, maybe not seeds, but like time bombs that right. they planted inside of me, that it just took a couple of more years to detonate. But that was my first time of you know, really kind of sitting down and looking at Gnostic scriptures. And it was around that time that I had seen your podcast or YouTube videos. And I remember just being very struck by the long intros that you would do and all of the different cultural pieces that it pulled in and realizing kind of like what you were saying earlier, that like the people who grew up when we did with those movies and those shows, like we were learning. I almost feel like a serious occultist kind of laugh at this stuff, but I'm much more interested in being a popularizer than being a serious occultist. And I feel like the Matrix, like it's, people act like it's corny to say, but I mean, my God, that movie was I don't think you could possibly overestimate the way that movie has shook the culture, like deeply. And it's a brilliant retelling of fundamental Gnostic mythology. And it changed the world. That movie changed the world. And so I discovered your podcast. So that was around the first time I had started thinking or hearing about Gnosticism, but I just could not make any sense of it. So I continued on with my path of Buddhist meditation, which, like I talked about in the group the other day, ultimately culminated in a very powerful Gnostic experience and encounter with the thing that then finally broke it all open for me.
Yeah, as you mentioned in our talk, you said that's also another experience that there had to be evil, or that there was evil. I think we were talking about, I was making a joke that whenever in Buddhism I talk about, well, the Buddha said there is no self and the self is unknowable. If I put this on Facebook, I get bum rushed by people comment, that's not true. They'll quote all these scriptures. I'm like, well, the original Buddhism was pretty Gen X, if you would, very existentialist, very dualistic. The Buddha was a punk rocker, you might say. But then religions have to get softened to get it. You can't get just the crazies like us, so you got to soften it up to make it. But tell us about your experience and how it strengthened evil, or reacquainted you with evil, Brian.
Yeah, I think that for me at least, the fundamental Gnostic awakening, or you know, maybe even the fundamental Christian awakening, was the realization of the Atman, of the self, of soul, of that thing which is, you know, looking out of my eyes and hearing through my ears right now, that thing was not non-existent or transitory or impermanent, as Buddhism had taught me for so many years, and as I was attempting to, you know, prove out by my meditation, I actually proved the exact opposite. And I really think there's something fundamental in that realization, at least for me and for other people I've talked to, that a real solid realization of self immediately is also realization of other. And that kind of resolved the question of the existence of God for me. And then very quickly on the heels of that, and I guess maybe I'm just kind of a dualist, but it was just immediately apparent to me that if there is a force of good and light and power and liberation and freedom, there is definitely a force that's working in the other direction. It's baffling to me. I live in a town in Asheville, North Carolina, that has a very new age kind of hippie vibe to it, which I, in a lot of ways, I like, in a lot of ways I resonate with, you know, manifesting your reality and like all of that kind of stuff. But this idea that everything is working towards the good and anything that seems bad is just, you know, it's just you haven't realized the good side of it. It's like you... I can't see how you can study the history of the 20th century and the gulags or the killing fields or Auschwitz and think that, you know, all is one and that these are just, you know, schools for all of these beings to realize their true divine nature. It's like, no, there's, it's rare. I think most people who do evil things are doing that because they themselves are hurt or they themselves are in ignorance or whatever. But there are definitely people out there that are, I think, possessed by something that's transhuman and that does not have the, you know, the, in the same way I think there's angelic forces, I guess I would say, I think that there are, or I'd say I know that there are archonic forces. And all of that just became immediately clear to me when I realized that I am self. You know, I feel like it just kind of, in some weird way, it just goes together. You know, it's almost impossible. I can't see how one, I can have one and not have the other. And so, around that time, it became very apparent to me, and I became very, you mentioned like the Gen Xers growing up with nihilism, and, you know, we've also grown up with, and this is getting even stronger, this kind of postmodern current of things, that there is no truth, that all of it, it's all relative and subjective, and I've become obsessed over the last 6 years since my awakening experience with the fact that, like, that does not seem to be the case to me at all. I think there is absolutely truth. I don't think morality is relative. There's definitely relative moralities, but I think there is the good and the true, and there is the evil, and there is sin, you know, in the sense of missing the mark and being off the path and moving away from the good. Yeah.
And Brian, how did you then fully come into Gnosticism later on?
Well, I had kind of right after the experience of waking up to self, I was practicing. There's a man, I don't know if people know who he is, and maybe that's a shame, named Alan Chapman, who was a chaos magician back in the 80s and 90s, and he ultimately left chaos magic after kind of having these same experiences of capital T truth. He wrote, Alan's gone through a few manifestations where he'll write some amazing books and get a really great website going and then kind of realize that it's not as accurate as he wants it to be and just pulls all his books away and takes his website down and you can't find him anymore. But he has a really great book, if you can find it, called The Blood of the Saints, that's basically like him charting his way through doing the Abramelin operation. And afterwards, he was teaching a series of meditations that were kind of like a stripped-down version of the Abramelin, very loosely based on Abramelin, but were with the goal of having knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel. And I'd reached out to Alan and was kind of talking to him about some of the experiences that I had had. And he was giving me some meditation instruction and I just had a surgery. So I had the chance to kind of go on retreat and went on retreat and was practicing some of these meditations and very quickly had the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel or the diamond or the twin or whatever you want to call it. And that being, I don't know how else to say this other than it just threw me onto the path of Christianity. Like it just would not let me do anything else. And I was horrified by this. I did not want to be a Christian. I thought Christianity was silly and oppressive and so basic. And I had all of the punk rockers' arguments against Christianity. I was horrified that, like, but anytime I tried to turn away from it, I was just miserable, and I just knew I had to engage with this. And I very quickly started listening to Jordan Peterson's Bible lectures and watching Bishop Stefan Heller's YouTube lectures and reading his books on Gnosticism. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, this is the way that I can relate to this tradition. This is a way that I can work very deeply with the symbols and capital M myth of Christianity in a way that is not offensive to my intellect and to my being and to my, you know, myself. And the more I learned about, I also started to listen to all of your back catalog at this point and learning more about the, you know, the early history of Christianity and getting really inspired by this idea of having a renaissance of like the early church where it's not this one, you know, unified orthodox thing, but it's like different communities working at it in all their different and unique ways. And felt really, really called to try to figure out how to do that. And like I said, since I was in my early teens, I'd wanted to be a Shaolin monk and a regular monk. And, you know, I've always felt called towards ministry. And one of my great aunts put it to me after my reconversion to Christianity. And she said, you know, you've always been called to ministry. And when she said that, I was like, yeah, you know, I maybe I could be a Gnostic priest. Maybe I could do this thing and play a role in bringing this church back. You know, maybe this is what I need to be doing with my life. And maybe this is the way I can serve the world. And so I sought out ordination and was ordained by a good friend of mine. And about a year later, he was like, him and some other priests were like, look, you know, we just need to make you a bishop so that you can just have full authority where you are to do your thing. Because after becoming a priest, you know, a lot of people become priests in these Gnostic lineages and just kind of have an internet church and really don't do anything. And I was not interested in that at all. I wanted to organize something on the ground where people came that would be something that you could bring your kids to and you could grow up in. And, you know, it would be a real source of community and something alive and real in the world. And so started doing that here and became a bishop. And in that time I reached out to Bishop John Plummer, who wrote a really great series of books on the independent sacramental movement. And, you know, I feel like God really put Bishop Plummer in my life and he just really took me under his wing and has been my spiritual mentor since then. And has just given me everything I want in the way of help and helping have the church here, and transmitted his lines of apostolic and esoteric ordination to me. We co-consecrated each other in a very moving ceremony for me. And it's just, you know, like since I've gotten on this path, I feel like all of the doors just fell open, you know. In my previous spirituality, I was trying so hard to make things happen. It's just never, you know, it's like one obstacle in front of the other. And I feel in a certain way like God was protecting me from these other things because of this idea of where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to be doing. So after that, it's just been trying to learn as much as I can about this and make my contribution to it and bring it to the world, because I feel like our culture is teetering on the edge, actually. And that I feel like the only thing that has a real chance of saving it is a deep connection to a spiritual reality. And so that's what I've been trying to do ever since.
Yeah, spiritual solution, I would say. As they say in AA, is I think the only solution today, but people will look where they're going to look. And beyond a priesthood, which is basically at the end of the day, being of service to other, helping out the community, being part of the community, how would you say Gnosticism or even Gnosis has helped your worldview, kept you sober, kept you from having another bad idea, like, I wonder if I could rob another bank or something? You know, those stupid ideas, what is A Course in Miracles says? God had one stupid, crazy idea, and look what happened. So,
yeah.
I'm doing that.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the minute you were saying that, I was thinking about So one of the things that I like to look at is, or I like to say to people is like, my Christianity is way older than anyone called Jesus or any, you know, particular event in any part of the world. I think these mythic cycles are older than time. And so I like to look around and see where I can see its footprint, you know, and a few years ago I was doing a lot of studying of Zoroastrianism and reading the Avestas and things like that, which I still love. And I there's something in, I think it's in the Avesta, where, you know, it's saying that the reason that humans are here, like we're here on this mission, you know, which is kind of like in the Matrix, right? We're here on this mission to help people wake up to our original status as sons and daughters of the Most High. I love the Hymn of the Pearl and talking about, you know, we've all kind of fallen into the flesh pots of Egypt and have forgotten the, you know, original splendor of the robe of glory. But the Father sends these messengers to be like, remember that note, you know, it tells you who you really are. And so for me, you know, one of the biggest things in my Gnostic Christianity is just waking up to the fact that my life has purpose that is bigger than my desire for things. You know, like I can't fall back into doing that stuff again because I'm here on a mission, you know, like I'm here on my Father's mission. I'm here to do my Father's work. You know, I think that it's something that modern people like to scoff at. But I try to be a hero. I want to be a hero. I want to live that life. I consider myself a knight and a warrior and someone who has a mission that's bigger than himself. And so that really directs, you know, virtually everything I do from, you know, waking up early and meditating and praying and working out every single day. You know, trying to be a good husband, trying to be a reliable, hard-working person at my job, you know, trying to be a good friend and a good member of the community, all of that stuff, and try to be an emissary of something good and powerful in the world is the main thing, I think, that keeps me, it's hard for me to conceive of not doing that. I would rather die than fall back into a life that neglects that purpose. And I think that that's, you know, one of the exciting things about Gnosticism as a religion is that this is baked into it. You know, we're all called to be Christ. We're all called to be Neo. It's like the story's about us. You know, it's our role. And if you, you know, if you can shake off the nihilism how would you say it? I think that the way that the culture currently just seems to sneer at the heroic, if you can shake that off, my God, what else is there to do? You know, like who doesn't want to do that? Like,
life. Yeah, I would agree with you. I think for all of you out there, you do have a true will, if you want to talk about the limb or sacred purpose, or once you align your soul to your higher self, it will happen and you will feel like a hero. And I'm sure you agree with me, Brian, that the great thing about Gnosticism is you don't have to lose your edge. In fact, I always think it's a prerequisite for Gnosticism to have still that punk rock edge, to have a really dark sense of humor. And even when I talk to some of my friends, I think Gnosticism is the one religion, if there is a commandment, is you have to make fun of yourself and your own religion, which I'm sure you do. I mean, Gnosticism mocks everything, but it mocks itself too.
Yeah, you have to, I think of this as something I've inherited from my father. You know, you have to be able to see all sides of the thing and see the weirdness. I mean, geez, if you take up a outward facing Gnostic path in this world, you know, one, everyone's going to think you're crazy because everyone knows that that Jesus stuff is just old-fashioned, you know, bullshit, and that what's really the thing is yoga or aliens or, you know, whatever, you know. So if you are all of a sudden talking about the Christ and, you know, reading the Old Testament, I mean, honestly, I think that that kind of stuff is the most kind of punk rock thing you can do. And I remember David Beth specifically telling me, you know, everybody wants to do Tantra and everybody wants to do this dark left-hand path stuff. And, you know, we look at, teaching a class here about this back when we could still meet in person, but saying, you know, the reason tantrikas in India drank alcohol and had sex and all of that kind of stuff is because that went completely against the cultural norms. Well, if you want to go completely against the cultural norms and be a tantrika, get married, you know, uphold monogamy, be a person who tells the truth, you know, be sober, right? Like these are the things that really cut against the current culture. You know, read scripture, pray.
Read a book.
Read a book. These things really do. I think with Gnosticism, you have to have that edge. Like you couldn't, you know, you probably couldn't do it without it. And having that edge shows up in ways you would never imagine. I did a friend's wedding 2 weeks ago and I was out there in my very Catholic looking robes and I see pictures of myself and it's like, oh my God, I can't believe that's me standing up there with this giant cross on, you know, doing this thing. But that's super edgy for me. You know, that's pushing way out to the edge of my comfort zone or what is comfortable. But I think G.K. Chesterton talked about that, like, you know, Christianity's not a, or maybe it was C.S. Lewis, that Christianity's not a religion to make you feel comfortable. You know, it's not a religion that's going to make you feel in harmony with things, and particularly these Gnostic manifestations of it, you know.
Agreed. 1 second, let me let the cat out. For the audience, I will put a blank space. All right, cat. Go out and find your gnosis. Okay. All right. Well, speaking of, I think this is a good segue into this. I love your ideas, Brian, of esoteric patriotism. So maybe you could share with the audience about it. You and I have had conversations in the past about it.
It's
definitely another solution we could use today.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody who's watching this is, if anybody sees this, is aware that we're living in like very fraught political times. And I know that people always, you know, think this, but I think we are in a unique situation, at least for anyone who's alive today, in the country right now. And I feel like what's happening more and more is that we're fracturing into different, what would you call it, different factions of almost the same idea. And on the left side of the spectrum, it's this idea of a collectivism that's based around, you know, it's a collectivism based around your identity, and the identity there is, you know, what group of oppressed, fragmented person do you fit into? And then on the right, on the extreme right, we're having this same sort of thing, this fracturing and this building of this this particular politic that's based around the common identity of race, right? So you've got it's almost like we've got the far left versions of communism and the far right versions of socialism, which are this ethno state kind of craziness. And it's fracturing more and more in these directions. And the more I thought about it, and was at the same time thinking about, the kind of founding of this country and even things that we saw happening in Europe, and the development of the idea of the individual and the rights of the individual and the role of the state in regards to those rights. And then you have this American experiment that happened in the later 1700s, where we have these documents that are unimaginably strange, where all of a sudden you're saying, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And we've all heard that since we were children in school and don't really think about what it means. But, you know, it occurred to me, like, what a revolutionary concept this was, that, like, your rights didn't come from government. They don't come from the state. It's not the role of the state to grant you or give you rights. Your rights come from God. And that those rights are based on the fact that we are all sparks of that God. We are all children of that God. And the divine inheritance we have is also why we have these cultural rules and norms that we just, at our detriment, take for granted. Jordan Peterson has this great way of talking about pointing this out by, you know, if me, you, and someone else were sitting at a public restaurant and I got up and killed somebody and everybody saw me do it, our culture does not accept the idea that then the logical thing we do is just grab me right there and hang me from a tree, right? The idea is that even if everyone sees me commit the crime, there is still something that has to be honored. I have to be brought in front of a court. I get to make a defense. I get to be judged by a jury of my peers, right? There's no logical reason for that. Like, the logical answer is, if you saw someone commit a murder, what more discussion does there need to be about it? But I think that this legal principle comes from the fact that it's a recognition of something divine inside that has to be treated with a certain respect in a certain way, even in the midst of the commission of some sort of horrible act. There's something precious and of worth there. And I started thinking about that when the Me Too movement was going on, and the kind of way in which it seemed like more and more people were wanting to enact some kind of legal or social system where innocence was not presumed, but guilt was presumed.
Right.
And I remember thinking that this was a very dangerous thing to start to do, that one thing, violating that one thing, would open the door to hell. All of a sudden, if what I had to do was prove my innocence, not that the community had to prove my guilt, that's a sure road to hell and tyranny. And that made me start thinking about these founding ideals. And at the same time, as I'm sure there's probably people yelling at the screen right now, well, yeah, they wrote those documents, but they owned slaves and they didn't let women vote and they didn't see black people as human. And it's right. Obviously, we know that these were flawed, you know, people. They didn't designate between right or left shoes either. Like, this was, you know, the 1700s. It was very early, but the principles that they were hitting upon, this was the thing that I was finding that my patriotism lay in, that in the roots, the cultural roots of the West, which, you know, I would describe and other people describe as kind of like the intersection of Jerusalem and Athens, this thing of, you have divine revelation, you have all human beings are created in the image of God. And then from Athens, you have the idea that, like, we can use our minds to figure out objective reality and to discover truth. And the melding of these two things seem to be at the root of Western culture. And I feel like that we are at a juncture where we're close to losing that. We're close to losing the idea that what we are is spirit soul, that we're more than, I'm a white male, heteronormative, or, you know, here's a black woman who identifies as trans. Like, these are not our identities. This is not the root of who and what we are. We come from something much deeper, than that. And we're also teetering to the point that we're giving up on the idea that there is an objective world that's knowable, that there are truths about things, that we can use our mind to discover those truths, that it's not all just subjective and based on my own, you know, personal individual experience, that there's things to learn and know about the world. And so I started thinking about that from a spiritual basis and feeling like I'm watching the country get torn apart and there being a loss of anything like an American identity, as it fractures into either the identities of the far left or the identities of the far right, which are both odious in my opinion and not a direction that I'm willing to go down. But I do think that there is something very capital T true at the heart of the American experiment that is worth preserving. But the only way that we will get to that is to engage with it and learn about it. And this drove me to become a Mason. And I think Freemasonry is a like an arc of a storehouse of these the symbol set of this Rosicrucian hermetic tradition that lays at the founding of this country. Stefan Heller has a really great book called Freedom, Alchemy for a Free Society. But he makes a really beautiful argument in there that America is not a Christian nation. America is a hermetic nation. It's a hermetic Rosicrucian nation. And reading that just had such a profound impact on me. And so I started, you know, kind of inspired by you, doing a podcast where I'm trying to work on these ideas. I've started working on a book about these ideas. And I try to do things that are, again, in my mind, very tantric because they cut. So I talk about patriotism. I use images of revolutionary era flags, and I proudly embrace and uphold these things, which is something that is just not seen very much. You know, I mean, we see the far right kind of bastardize these symbols in a pornographic way, and we see the far left, you know, just want to tear them and set them on fire. And I've just come to realize that, like, I'm not letting either one of these two groups of people destroy my heritage and my birthright. And so that's kind of been my project for the last few years, is figuring that out. And up until now, it's mainly just been trying to kind of figure out my thinking about it and, you know, coming up with, like, answers to the questions of, oh, well, you're just talking about Americans, or, you know, does Western just mean white, or is it just, you know, is it just for Europeans? Are you excluding, you know, all of these kinds of typical questions that would logically come up from that, and attempting to work through the answers of it, and now trying to put that down onto paper and into my podcast, and you know, trying to evangelize with that.
That's awesome, Brian. And yes, Heller's book is very good. I have it right here on the shelf. And yes, I would agree. This is the nation of Hermes, and Hermes is the god of innovation, the god of freedom, the god of rights, and places like Alexandria and the Renaissance, Florence and the United States. When Hermes gets Haram in the Middle East, when Hermes gets there, there is an explosion of ideas, innovation, creativity. So reason I'm doing this podcast is to hopefully give Hermes another chance to see how he incarnates in the 21st century, and we shall see. But it's been a great conversation, Brian. Real quick for the audience, because I want people to have some takeaways. I think you've given a lot by your inspirational life, but what are four or five spiritual exercises you do today?
So one of the things that I started doing a couple of years ago is praying the hours. So I'm very interested in the Knights Templar and consider myself part of that stream. And one of the rules of the Templars was you had to pray one of the hours every day. You know, they were involved in different things, so they couldn't do all of them, but you had to commit to doing one. So every morning, you know, my spiritual discipline is I get up pre-dawn every morning and I come in and pray louds, like the morning prayers. And I've put together a series of prayers from the Gnostic Mass and from the liturgy of the Liberal Catholic Church, along with the Kabbalistic cross and intoning, doing Gnostic vow chants as part of that morning prayer cycle. And I do that 7 days a week, every day, start the day with those prayers. I do a short version. Like when I say short, I mean, like if I only have 2 minutes, you know, at noon, I pray again, just kind of recentering myself as a spiritual being in the midst of, you know, my work day. And in the morning, I always, you know, pray to God that I'm dedicating the day to the service of light, to the service of the Most High. And then at noon, I'll do that again. You know, I rededicate myself in the middle of the day. And then at night, I pray with my spouse before we go to bed. We pray together. And the same thing, just kind of, you know, reflecting on the day, giving thanks for the day, making pledges in the ways that I will, you know, be better than I have been at the end of that day if I'm given the chance to do it again tomorrow. So those morning prayers are my main spiritual discipline, and also a daily physical exercise. I feel like it's important for me, and I think, you know, for most people, if they started doing it, to have a strong, capable, healthy body and a clear thinking mind. I do martial arts a lot. I've done it my whole life. I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So I, you know, go train 3 or 4 times a week. I think it's important to do some hard sparring, to be involved in combat, particularly if you see yourself as part of any kind of a warrior tradition. I think you need to, you know, go engage in that and engage in physical confrontation and, you know, learn to deal with the anxiety and stress and fear that comes from that. Learn to win, learn to lose, compete, all of that. So I consider my physical training completely integrated with my spiritual path. My partner is a body worker, a functional medicine practitioner, and we both very much see the body and spirit as being intimately connected. And so I feel like having a strong, healthy body helps me have a strong and healthy spirit. And also it's just, I feel like discipline is very important. I know that I learned in prison that I worked very well with disciplined regimens, particularly as someone who had been an addict. I think about it like turning my addict superpower into something good. Like I was really good at doing heroin every single day, man. I never missed a day, you know, I never missed a day. And I'm like that with working out and with praying and meditating. You know, I'm an addict for it. I don't miss, I do it every day. It's what I do. And so I think it's very important to have a spiritual discipline. A lot of people struggle with that, and I would recommend, you know, start with something small, maybe 5 minutes of meditation, but do it every day. You know, if you miss a day, don't beat yourself up. Don't quit. Just get right back on it. You know, like relapsing is kind of part of the thing of getting clean, right? It just happens. And I think it's important. I do it every morning because it works with my work schedule, but reading some spiritual material every morning, reading some scripture or the writings of someone that you really like, or a study in an esoteric subject. But every single day, I feel like it's important to put good in. You know, we live in this like really unique time where you can pretty much choose any of the input you want to receive. Like there's so many good podcasts. There's so many good YouTube lectures. There's audiobooks if you don't like reading. But like I think it's very important every day to study the esoteric material and to, so many people are armchair academic Gnostics or occultists, and they read a lot of books. And I do too. I love reading books and I love talking about this stuff. But, you know, you really at some point you have to get up and do the practices if you want to If you want to get free, you know, if your goal is freedom, you can't just sit in your cell and read books. Like you got to do the work, you know.
Exactly, and well said. Well, as we end, where can people find more about you, Brian, on the internets?
Yeah, you can find my podcast. It's called Modern Gnostic, and it's on all the main, it's on Apple, iTunes, and Spotify, and Google, and all of that. You can find it there. I'm also on Facebook, Brian Stanford, my name. I love accepting friend requests and talking to people. If you're needing help with something or trying to get a spiritual routine started, I'm happy to respond to messages and help. So, you know, check out the podcast and subscribe and share it around. And if you like it and you think it's good and it inspires something in you, reach out to me. If you're in North Carolina or anywhere near the Asheville area, we're about to start having the Gnostic Temple meeting in person again in November. So we typically meet twice a month. We celebrate the Eucharist on one of those, and then on one of the other ones, we have a study and meditation. So if anybody's in the surrounding area and wants to come check that out, reach out to me on social media and I'll get you plugged in for that. So yeah, mainly find me through my podcast or on Facebook.
Instagram. Wonderful. Well, I will, as always, have show notes on both the video and the audio versions. But Brian, thank you very much for sharing your story, your spirituality, all about you. And definitely thank you very much for coming on Finding Hermes.
Well, thank you, man. And Miguel, it's been, I can't tell you what it feels like to sit here and talk to you after listening to so many years and listening to so many episodes. And I mean, just like what an amazing time that kind of like your heroes in regards to something, you can reach out to them and talk to them I love what you're doing, and I just think it's such a great thing for the world, and it definitely changed my life. So thank you. Thank you for doing this.
I appreciate it. Of course, we're all just lights on a journey helping one another. Like you said, it's very democratic, as Hermes would have it. And the internet has made it even more. We can share our ideas and without too much of a hierarchy. That's what I love about it. So,
yeah.
But Brian, thank you very much, and we'll definitely have you on in the future.
All right, brother.
And there you have it. Talk about laying your cards on the table. Our interview with Brian Stanford. Quite a journey, and I'm sure we could have gone a lot longer. So hopefully we'll have Brian on in the future. Definitely I have my own takeaways from it. I think the main one I have is Brian's idea of going back to the religion of your fathers. To some of you, that maybe seem a little bit cray-cray. I mean, many of us put a lot of work into getting away from these religions, these orthodox faiths that traumatized us when we were young, and we're happy to have evolved and gained some distance. But I disagree with Tom Wolfe and his famous saying, "You can never go back home again." I think we have to go back home. Why is that? Because in a way we have to face the past. We have to reconcile all of ourselves, including our past selves. We have to have a more, again, holistic whole view of our entire life, past, present, and future. And we have to, well, and by seeing new dimensions of ourselves, of our past, new perspectives of our past religions, it will open up a lot of more doors to peace, to serenity, to understanding, to seeing the whole picture. It reminds me very much of that saying I often quote on Aeon Bite by Tom Robbins. It's never too late to have a happy childhood. And we can have a happy childhood by, again, seeing those new dimensions and perspectives, by seeing our past with empathy, with new vistas, with new understandings. When we go back to the past, to the religions of our fathers, as Brian called them, we will see what was wrong with the people there. And it really comes down to they were afraid. Perhaps those in your past who were part of these religions, they were afraid of hell. Maybe they were afraid of heaven. Maybe they were afraid that if no one acted the same or believed the same, then they might be wrong about their spirituality. They were afraid, and we have to understand that and in a way forgive them for it. At the same time, I think we will find in our past religions, in the religion of our fathers, we'll find that these religions were not all that bad, that they were like our lives, they were part of a continuum, a part of humanity's search for transcendence, for belonging in this universe, for becoming something better. And once we find that, we will also find a lot of insight and holiness and wonderful ideas and a lot of heart with these old religions and the people that participated in them, even if we think, again, they traumatized us and they blocked us off and they tried to suppress our hearts, which they did, but they were afraid, and fear is the mind killer, as I keep saying. And we can be like the Valentinians in Rome in the 2nd century, or the Sethians in the Neoplatonic universities in the 3rd and 4th century. We can use the religions of our fathers and rewrite them, reinterpret them, find new insights that will make our lives better, and the gems that are there in the muck of these orthodox religions. So yes, you can go back and have a happy childhood, because you'll find new dimensions of these religions, of yourselves, of the people. And once you have empathy, once you have forgiveness, then your past self will be released from so much, and your present self will be more liberated. I know it's hard, but in a way it is necessary. I mean, I think it has to be done, as this quote, my favorite quote from the movie Magnolia, probably Tom Cruise's best performance, is the saying that goes throughout the movie: you may be through with the past, but the past ain't through with you. So might as well go back to the past. And as the Gospel of Thomas says, once you know the past, you will know the end, and you will rule over all. Or I think it says, once you must go to the beginning to know the end. The other takeaway from Brian's interview, and I have many takeaways, but I don't want to take too much of your time. But let me know how I am doing with my commentaries, or what I could do better. But that is Brian's idea of perspective, how we tend to judge those in the past. I guess that's the theme, right? Going to the past. How we tend to judge harshly our ancestors and historical figures. And it really comes down to perspective. As one of my favorite quotes from my favorite New Age book, perhaps Illusions by Richard Bach, is perspective. Use it or lose it. And this reminds me of in my life, a long time ago, many moons ago, I was dating an Indian girl. And she told me that every generation in India sees Gandhi differently. In other words, one generation sees him as a saint, and the next one will see him as the devil. And why is that? I mean, there's no real October surprises, if you know what I mean. Sure, there's maybe a book or a documentary, but these generations see Gandhi completely different.
And it all comes down to perspective. And like the religion of the, like the religions of your father, these historical figures, it's all about seeing them as a whole, seeing them completely. Gandhi is certainly a figure that changed history, but he was a flawed individual. He was an individual that was both heaven and hell, as the Sufi poem talks about each one of us. Each one of us are heaven and hell if we go look inside enough. So we simply have to see someone like Gandhi in a totality, in a perspective. Perspective, use it or lose it. But that, when she told me that, it really changed the way I looked at people, the way I looked at history. And we can't be too judgmental with those that came before us, because again, they had a certain consciousness. They certainly had some blind spots, but like us today, they had, they had to get through the end of the day. It's very hard to get through the end of the day. We all got to put money on the table, deal with other people, and engage in the harshness of life. We can't be sitting there all, we can't be seeing all of our blind spots, and when we see them, we can't really address them all the time. I mean, if we want to judge our ancestors and those in the past harshly, we'll probably be judged very harshly ourselves. I mean, look at today. As I've mentioned before, we in a way support slavery. How do we do that? Well, with this. We have our tools are probably built by slave labor, and many of us know this, but again, how do we get to this issue? It's harder than you think, and many people simply have blind spots to it. Even issues like how we treat animals, how we treat the environment, future generations will think, well, what was wrong with them? Couldn't they see the solutions? Couldn't they see what was so wrong? Well, we tried. We did the best that we could. And all we can do is just evolve and hopefully improve. So my takeaway is don't judge those too harshly in the past, because, you will be judged too. So how do we change our perspective? Well, as I certainly have mentioned, we have to have more understanding. We have to have more empathy. We have to understand when we're projecting upon others, which is usually most of the time. And we have to see the divinity in everybody and the struggles that everybody goes through as a people, as individuals. Recovery, those of you in recovery, I'm sure you know that when we have a resentment towards others, it seems nothing is good with that person. And maybe for people who aren't even in recovery, maybe you see you have a resentment and because of something a person did to you or something a person said to you or you are something like that. And you, that person, well, it seems that person's nothing is good with that person. Their taste in music sucks. What they wear sucks. How they speak is terrible. And then all of a sudden you might, well, your perspective is expanded. You might get some new piece of information. And it almost seems that person is completely transformed. Well, their taste in music wasn't so bad. What they wear isn't so bad. I mean, it's just part of them. And it's just fine. So keeping yourself free of resentment and anger and being neutral as possible when you see people as a whole is very important in keeping your perspective right and seeing having a holistic view of a person and a holistic view of people that came before you and a holistic view of the religion of your fathers. I know it's not easy, but it's pretty simple. Do you want to be judgmental? Do you want to be right about others? Or do you want to be free? Do you want to be happy? So that's my couple of takeaways from an excellent interview with Brian Stanford. And very excited about the other Finding Hermes that will be coming out in the near future. I hope I can do more of these, But honestly, I don't know how these interviews are going or how the project is going. Something stirred with me. I wanted to help people, especially in 2020, although the insights or the gnosis came to me probably December of 2019, but Hermes stirred within me, and I wanted to find my Hermes, and I wanted to help you find your Hermes so you could walk through those doors. So I hope this is helping. Again, I have no idea. Leave some comments, send me some messages, and I hope I am inspiring you. I hope that I am finding, well, you are finding your Hermes, but that you are getting the information that you can walk through those doors and gain the ability to set all your cards on the table so you can become transparent to the transcendent, as Joseph Campbell said, or as Mary Magdalene says in the Dialogue of the Savior, you can become transparent to the cosmic. Because then you're free, and then you have nothing to gain and nothing to lose, because you are truly part of the all, and you truly know what your purpose is. So I hope you've enjoyed this Finding Hermes, and we will talk sooner than later. Keep walking through those doors.